Virgil?
No one will hire you because of your quirk-like...
Quirk?
Want to turn it around?
What do you mean, Mr. Kravitz?
I mean because I admire you, I'll throw you some work like... Gotta turn it around.
You mean it, you'd give someone like me a job in spite of... You know.
You know.
Virgie's epileptic.
Virgil, you're a chum. And what else, my friend, could there be to know?
That's wonderful.
Well, if you believe in a pal, you should boost his morale, especially when it's no less than he's earned. So, Virgil, it's me and you.
And Yvette,
they're her too. And we'll turn it like it's never been turned.
It's never been turned.
Just like that said. When life is upsetting,
you can turn it around.
You can turn it around.
When
dreams in your head.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway for Sunday, February 19th, 2017. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Yes, Michael's interview in the Everything Sondheim magazine is really terrific, and I urge everyone to subscribe to this because Everything Sondheim is the new iteration of the Sondheim Review, which many of us really enjoyed during the years that it was publishing. But now we have a new forum, and I'm very glad that Michael's a big part of it because he asks the good questions.
Well, thank you very much. You're not going to believe this. I got the hard copy in the mail just the other day, and I didn't look through it yet. I didn't have a chance. I didn't know my interview was in there.
It's there.
With Glenn Carew.
Yeah, indeed.
Oh, how wonderful.
Pay attention, Michael.
Well, I just got it. I didn't have a chance to look through it. I got a nice note from Rick Pender, but I didn't. That's great. I do know. I flipped through it, and it looks fantastic.
Yeah, really.
In terms of the graphics and everything.
And color pictures, too. Really some dramatic ones. It's really a terrific magazine. There's marvelous information on Boris Aronson, a terrific article on what he did, a fascinating article on Company dealing with productions in Massachusetts, where it seems to be very, very popular. And that's very nice because, after all, Company started there in Massachusetts way back in March of 1970. A lot of other treats as well. So I do urge you to look up Everything Sondheim. And I think you'll be very pleased by the magazine and the ensuing website as well.
Oh, that's really great. EverythingSondheim.org. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. And Michael, you have to learn what you're supposed to do. Every time you pick up a magazine or a book, you flip right to the index and look for your own name.
Well, I just was surprised that he hadn't specifically told me. But that's great. That's fantastic.
Uh-huh. So there you go.
With us today, we have a very special guest joining us, David Spencer. David is a composer, lyricist, librettist, author, and musical theater teacher. His musical, The Fabulous, for which he wrote the music and lyrics, won the Richard Rodgers Development Award. He is also the lyricist librettist for two musicals with composer Alan Menken, Weird Romance, and The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz, which we're going to talk about a little bit more because it just came out in a cast recording. He's an accomplished author.
Duddy Kravitz. It rhymes with Goody.
Oh.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, Duddy Kravitz.
What do you know? Duddy Kravitz.
Duddy Kravitz. We'll have to talk about, you know, the interesting name there in a minute. He is on the steering committee and teaching faculty of the BMI Lehman Engel Musical Theater Workshop. And David, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and chatting with us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'm always happy to talk about myself and, you know, but I'm glad to talk about the album and stuff, sure.
Well, The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz is just been released by Ghostlight Records. Mm-hmm. It's an original cast recording. So tell us a little bit more about Duddy Kravitz.
Dudi Kravitz was Alan and I were originally approached to write a version of it way back in the 80s, right as the adaptation of La Boheme I did at the Public Theater was closing. We at first did a version that played at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia in 1987. Austin Pendleton, who would direct the subsequent show, which opened in Montreal, directed it there. He was also the librettist. It didn't work for a whole bunch of reasons that would just be too convoluted to go into now. There were great things about it, of course, and we really love the story, and so we wanted to keep going with it. Austin was fired, not by us. It was a very unfortunate production situation. But I lobbied to do the libretto. And eventually, after several misadventures, I think I just wore people down, and they said, all right, fine. I spent about 6 weeks trying to do some kind of revisionist version of what we had, because, you know, we've got a full score and we did all that work, and I just could not make it work. And finally hit the wall strongly enough to say, I have to go back to the beginning. And so I blew it up and I started again. And what happened was, it was sort of one of those lightning bolt moments. I went back to the film because at that point I knew the novel too well and it wasn't helping me anymore. Dudi Kravitz is about a pushy Jewish kid in the Montreal St. Urban Street ghetto area. It's not such a ghetto anymore. Inner city area, really. From circa about 1950 is when it takes place. And he's pretty disenfranchised. He doesn't have a mother. His mother died when he was very young. And it's the family of men, an older brother, a father, an uncle. And but he's told by his grandfather, who's the only one who really has time for him, that a man without land is nobody. So he sets off to get land, sort of understanding the words but not really the resonance. And he encounters a lot of situations where he has to make moral decisions. And sometimes he does it well and sometimes he doesn't. And what happens in the novel, which is a much somewhat darker trip than the musical, he has a very compromised victory at the end. But his father buys into it. And his father has at the beginning of the book, somewhere near the beginning, been talking about a local gangster who is nicknamed the Boy Wonder, as if he's some kind of great icon. And at the end of the book, he's talking about Dudi the same way, as if Dudi has become an icon. And so knowing that, I went back to the film to watch the film, and it opens with this great panoramic sequence of graduation day for Fletchersfield High School. And Dudi is running in and out of the parade, being mischievous. And then that sequence kind of fades into the next sequence, which is him doing his chores in the morning before going off to work. It's a wonderful movie, but it's kind of a messy movie too. But I was looking at that sequence, and without really any dialogue at all, it told you a ton of stuff. And I thought, gosh, that's great. And I can't use any of it because it's completely cinematic. I need the equivalent of a camera. And I went to sleep. And I woke up, literally woke up in the middle of the night and thought, oh, my God, I know what to do. I said, because I realized that speech that Max has at the end when he's talking about Dudi, I said, if I pull that back to the beginning, do I lose anything in terms of suspense, in terms of anything? And it turned out not only didn't I, but I gained a ton of stuff. Because Max, in talking about being our narrator and talking about Dudi, he tacitly says something that he never actually has to say out loud, which is, let me tell you the story of how I fell in love with my son, which makes a very tricky character instantly kind of lovable to an audience, which isn't sure which way they're going to go with him. And it also allowed me to turn the theater into a black box space, the stage, I mean, the playing space into a black box space, because I didn't need sets anymore of any complexity. Max can say, we're here, we're there, we're somewhere else. And he could also give you the lens through which to look at something. And so the opening of the show, as it is on the album, is Max saying, even as a kid, way back there before he had begun to make his mark, my boy was a troublemaker. He was born on the wrong side of the tracks with a rusty spoon in his mouth and a spark of rebellion in him. So that sets up the tone. There's a curious bit of stage paradoxia, if I may make up a word, that I've thought about and I've thought about. I don't have an explanation for it. Nobody ever seems to question it. In fact, I argued with an author, a colleague of mine, or debated really, taking the negative side of it. And he said, no, you were right, which is that Max is a smarter narrator than he is a character in the piece. Mm-hmm. There's this strange kind of bifurcation, and yet it kind of works because there's a magic of being a narrator that lets him do that. And that started the journey. And in doing that, of course, the entire book that we'd had in Philadelphia went away. And basically it became a completely new musical with the same title. And about three quarters of the original score went away. And what remained, most of it, was heavily revised. So basically what opened in Montreal after all those years of working on it was, in fact, the world premiere.
Uh-huh. Now, I find it very interesting that you're talking about revising it so much because, of course, your second act opener, one of the great second act openers of all time, a melody that will intoxicate anybody who hears it, and a wonderful lyric to match, is called Turn It Around. And it's all about when things go poorly, you have to turn it around. That's exactly what you did.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, that was there's a thing that happens when you're working on a show and you're working with people who are friendly to it, which I know sounds odd, but sometimes, especially with complex material, you can be working with people who think they're friendly to it but aren't. But in Montreal, everything was in alignment, more so than I think in any other point in my career. It was just kind of magical. And I don't mean to say that we didn't have our moments. You know, there was creative abrasion, certainly. But we were all aiming at the same target. And we were all passionate about it as opposed to, you know, our egos. And what happens when the show is, especially when you as a writer, suddenly get that insight that allows you to, head toward the end with some kind of speed. It's what I personally call being in the center of the show. And it's like straightening out a carpet. You know, the more you get rid of the big lumps, the more the smaller lumps are visible and the more you know what's up. And not to drop a name, but I was doing one of the master classes at BMI and Stephen Sondheim was the guest, and we were in the back room behind the classroom, just chatting away before class started. And we started to talk about this phenomenon. And I said, it's like a physical sensation when you know the show is clicking. And he said, yes, it is. It's absolutely a physical sensation. Mm-hmm. And I had that about Dirty. Spent a number of years trying to protect that, sometimes losing. But when we got to Philadelphia, as I say, we had a brilliant, brilliant artistic director, Lisa Rubin, at the Siegel Center for Performing Arts, who was also the assistant director and really earned her title. She was great. And Austin directing. And Austin is, if I may say so, he's one of the few guys I know who I would say is a better dramaturg than I am.
and we know you're telling the truth, even though you wrote a song called What a Liar, which is another earworm that is so good.
Thank you.
Terrific work. And yet, the songs I'm talking about are up-tempo songs, and the one that really lands with an audience is Welcome Home, the song at the end of the show, which I know got cheers in Philadelphia every night. People were just thrilled by it. So it's so nice to hear Alan Menken also writing for real people as opposed to cartoon characters and adult characters. I always like when he does that. I really enjoy his work when he is able to write a serious story, and he certainly succeeded here. So now, was it hard getting everybody back together? I mean, you know, like so many shows, people say, well, let's try it again. They say, oh, please, we've done it. It's no, go away. You know, I mean, was here you are dealing with Alan Menken and Austin Pendleton decades later. Was it hard getting them back in the fold?
No, Alan had never left. In fact, he heroically kept pumping money into it all through the years in terms of maintaining, you know, the rights and et cetera. As for Austin, we'd had a number of misadventures with stage readings and of various success. None better than the first one before people put their limits on it, you know. But then after a pause of a couple of years and another, I won't say misadventure, a kind of actually rather gratifying adventure with Cheryl Kaller, who is a wonderful director. We had a good time with it, and just for personal reasons that really didn't have to do with our relationship. She just had stuff going on in her life. We had stuff going on, kind of drifted. Mm-hmm. But she was great, and she was an asset. And but then we were like, who are we going to go to? And I had I was on a trip to London, actually to see a play that Austin had directed and to do some networking. Austin was directing a play called Detroit at the National. It was his first time directing in like 20 years. He had directed Little Foxes there too, after he'd done it on Broadway. And it just happened by the sheerest coincidence that the night before I was to have breakfast with Austin at the hotel where he was staying, I turned on to Skype and I saw Alan. And he was in Paris while I was in London. So instead of being 5 hours apart, we were an hour apart. Uh-huh. So we had a long conversation, and at one point I said to him, what would you think about Austin directing it again? And he gave me a thumbs up. Mm-hmm. So the next morning I went to Austin, you know, I met Austin, and he said, tell me everything that's happening with Judy and don't leave anything out. Tell me in order. So I said, well, okay. So I spent about 20 minutes telling him all the various adventures and misadventures, saving the punchline. And at the end of this 20 minutes, I said, and so Alan and I were wondering if you would like to direct it again. He threw himself literally against the back of his chair as if somebody had socked him in the stomach very hard. Uh-huh. Air blew out of his mouth. And he said, well, that's a sentence I never thought I'd hear again in my lifetime. Sure. And then there was a little pause and he said, you remember I was fired, right? And I said, we didn't fire you. And so, so he said, okay. And then came the second misadventure, which it would take me 20 minutes to tell you in detail, of how it got produced. There were two crazy-ass lines of insane serendipity. What happened was, on one end, I became a fan of a Canadian TV show called Republic of Doyle, which is a kind of a private eye thing that was not being broadcast in the States. But one of my students, now a close friend and an ally and a colleague of mine, Jonathan Monroe at BMI, he's also an actor. In fact, he's co-starring in a play at the Centaur in Montreal right now. Oh. But he's also a brilliant musician and composer and musical director. And a colleague of his, one of his collaborators at BMI, said, and he'd had a pivotal role in an episode of Doyle. And one of his friends said, you know, Spencer's a big fan of Doyle. He said, no way. He's a way. You should talk to him. Mm-hmm. He comes to me and he says, how are you seeing it? So I kind of under my breath, well, I'm downloading it, you know. And then he said, well, I'm putting together a musical theater concert in St. John's. And we're talking about Newfoundland.
Wow.
We're putting on a musical theater concert. I'm going to be one of the stars, and so is Kristen Pellerin. Now, Kristen Pellerin was one of the stars of Doyle. And I said, wow, that's great. I said, well, I got something for Kristen to sing. He says, what do you have? I said, I've got the Apprenticeship of Duty Kravitz. It doesn't get more Canadian than that. So I sent him the song. He liked it. She liked it. 2 weeks later, he calls me up. He says, you know, I'm not the right type. I'm too old. I'll never play the role of Duty, but I would love to sing these two songs, and they need character actors to play against. Would you come up and do the character roles? I said, yes. So the new songs and actually one old one were orchestrated brilliantly by Aaron Elder. We did the concert. And long story short, here's what gets short. Jonathan is very interested in the show. We just started networking in the Canadian theatrical community. The other line of serendipity started with a musical theater writer who lives in Montreal. His name is Elon Kunin, who's had a couple of shows produced there, and one that came to New York, Lies My Father Told Me, which, Peter, you might know about.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of years before, his wife had seen my book on the show, Musical Theater Writer Survival Guide, and bought him a copy. And he liked it so much that he found me on Facebook and just sort of popped up and, you know, wanted to know if he could ask me some questions. I said, sure, of course. And we started conversing and became friends. And at the point where we were several weeks into networking, we were typing on Facebook. And I told him that we were looking for a venue for Duty. And he said, oh, I think the Siegel Center would be great for that. I said, the Siegel Center? I said, now there was a possible conflict of interest involving the Siegel Center that I won't particularize here. I said to him, and the Siegel Center had produced his other work. And I said to him, what about that conflict of interest situation? And he typed back, I wouldn't worry about that. And I typed back, why not? Back, because my wife runs the theater. And his wife was Lisa Rubin. Lies My Father Told Me was about to go into rehearsal, and he was in New York, and then he called me suddenly, and I think it may have been on a Sunday morning, Saturday night or a Sunday morning. She flew in to surprise him to see his first preview. And he gets, she's here, do you want to meet her? I said, yes. So we put together a very hasty meeting at a little Thai restaurant on 9th Avenue. And by the time the meeting was over, we had pretty much agreed that it was going to get done. As with any producer, she wanted to see it, but clearly it was, I want to see it because I just want to look at it for the joy of it, because she didn't have, she wanted to do it. It was one of those rare meetings where you're looking at somebody whose life is going to be in your, you know, who's going to take sure. life in their hands, I should say.
That's right. That's
something you really care about. And I did not have a qualm, you know, when you know you're going to be in great hands. And she was terrific, and she remains terrific and a good friend, and she's doing brilliant things for that theater up there. And I had pretty much as much as one can have, you know, in the pressure cooker, the time of my life up there. And we cast the best actors in the land. They were from all over the country. And it was great. And we sold out. We were extended twice. We had standing O's at every performance, which I know come cheap these days, but ours started before the house lights came up. And it worked, you know, exactly the way I'd hoped it would work. And I don't know what the future will be. We are, as they say, having those conversations.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's, I think in my life I have and probably will write as well. I will never write better. And I think Alan knows that too, you know, about him. He knows that in many ways it's some of his best work.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think that the releasing a cast recording now of the Canadian cast will help build support for a Broadway production of this?
Well, gosh, I hope so.
Mm-hmm. You know, me too.
You know, you can never tell, of course, and especially now, getting a musical on is
a miracle.
More difficult, I think, than when I started in this career with blinders on. You know, we've got that homunculus in the White House and who knows what's going to happen with arts. I hope so. You know, what was good about the production and the reviews and et cetera is where previous to Montreal, because we'd been at it so long, we had a reputation for being shocked. You know, it was, oh, that damn.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, get off my lawn, you know.
Yeah.
And after it opened, we had a buzz back. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, we're still enjoying the buzz. I don't know how big it is or how widespread, but it's enough so that there is stuff to talk about with people. Mm-hmm. Don't know what's going to happen. I know the show kicks butt. You know, I know what the audience has told us. And I hope it gets done in a venue in New York and gets to enter the literature.
Well, I don't want to put either you or Peter on the spot here, but I read that Peter called the show a masterpiece and placed it along Hamilton as the other best musical of 2015.
That's exactly right.
It seems as though that... that this is not just hyperbole here, that we have a real contender here. So tell us about the how did your relationship with Alan Menken develop? I mean, certainly you had your previous project with him, that little weird romance thing. So tell us, how did you originally meet Alan?
Well, we met at the BMI workshop, and it was he was still going there semi-regularly. He and Howard Ashman. Howard was never officially a member of the workshop, but the workshop is happy to claim him, you know, because they worked out Little Shop there. And they actually did an Authors Perform Everything reading with Layman Engel moderating some months before it opened, just to run it past the class. I've heard Alan tell the story about how he thinks that the reading was basically a failure, but basically it wasn't. I was there. It was a huge success. I think the only thing that was questioned was I don't think anybody exactly got the idea of what was behind the soul singing plant because you couldn't quite see it, you know. And it wasn't quite designed, you know, and it wasn't designed. So, you know, you're hearing a description of it, and it was, how is this not an anachronism? Well, you know, when you see the whole thing, you go, oh, okay, now I get it. But basically, they made, you know, it worked pretty well. And shortly after that, I don't remember when, oh, you know what it was? I think there was a showcase. It was a BMI showcase prior to Little Shop opening, which featured some Little Shop songs that went really well. And at one point, I was sitting next to Alan, and I said, do you want to work on something together? He said, yes, that fast. Yeah. And we did.
So the apprenticeship of Duty Kravitz was recorded and is available on Ghostlight. And thank you so much for coming on and telling us about this. We're going to play a handful of the pieces of a few of the tracks just to give our listeners a chance to get a little glimpse into it, and they can get over to Shikaboom and pick it up. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning, David. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I ought to wring your neck. I ought to slap your face. I ought to halt the stretch, you ought to wipe your nose and get out of my place. But you're as cute as can be, so quit your jumping around. You wanna do some business with me, you're gonna do it sound.
Okay, Mr. Cole,
sit.
But
But you don't understand.
Shut up! I'd like to see you get a start. The bargaining commences. Look in my eyes and from the heart, tell me your expenses.
About 900 to 1,000 to make.
Liar! What a liar, wow, what a liar. Call the cops, I caught me a liar. Wouldn't know from truth if it grew on a bush. But shut up! What a liar, what a liar. About as phony as a warehouse fire. You could close your mouth, you'd lie through your tush.
Please, Mr. Cohen, if you could just see
but
it.
All right, try me again. Let's not fight. We're rational men. I'll pay you a grand, you adorable prankster.
Well, it feels like we're partying like it's 1999, which is, of course, a reference to the Prince song. But all things aside, back in 1994, we all saw Sunset Boulevard with Glenn Close. And this week, we all saw Sunset Boulevard with Glenn Close just across the street and up a few blocks this time. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with Sunset Boulevard?
Well, we're all looking forward to seeing a certain star descending a staircase and hearing a bunch of waiters tell her, it's so nice to have you back where you belong. But Glenn Close in Sunset Boulevard has beaten Bette Midler both to the staircase and to town. So while Dolly Levi has all those waiters to serenade her, Norma Desmond can console herself with those wonderful people out there in the dark who 8 times a week are giving her wild applause and cheers. And what I really found most interesting about this was that director Lonnie Price has her enter way, way, way high above the action to the point of which she's almost rubbing her head against the ceiling of the Palace Theater. People are so anticipating her entrance that even though it's in the upper right-hand corner of the proscenium, so high up, it's amazing to me that people even caught her coming in. But a lot of this has to do with the fact that they're waiting for her. They know she's going to make the entrance, and because we know Sunset Boulevard very well. I'm going to say something very controversial here with so many people, because I have heard this musical trashed now and forever. But I've always thought it was an excellent musical version of the 1950 film Sunset Boulevard. And I'm very enthusiastic about the music. I think it's one of Andrew Lloyd Webber's best. It's a show I never tire of seeing. I saw it with Betty Buckley. I saw it with Elaine Page. I saw it with Petula Clark. So it's really a terrific work. And again, if you go and disagree with me, I won't be surprised because so many people do. Though I do think it's an Andrew Lloyd Webber backlash that really was happening there, that people were resenting his tremendous success and didn't want to give him a break. But I think it's a wonderful score. And of course, it's heard to very good advantage here because what we have are more than 36 musicians on stage, much like encores. And so especially the way it opens, because you hear the strings and it's such a wonderful opening that the song The Greatest Star of All is what starts the overture, and it has that wonderful movie music feel to it. And hearing a real Hollywood treatment, because Hollywood orchestras are always bigger than Broadway orchestras, even when Broadway orchestras were Broadway orchestras as opposed to bands, is what we have now in most Broadway shows. But anyway, so it starts off really tremendously because you're really so impressed by that sound. Now, I mentioned encores, but in a way that's not a fair comparison because indeed, while encores have certainly spiffed up over the years and they're no longer readings and we even get a bit of scenery, this one we had heard, you know, well, there's no real set. Yes, there is. Excuse me, there is. And frankly, considering the set, Glenn Close has to climb and descend many more stairs than she did in the original. This one really is almost a jungle gym of a set. And very dark and very brooding. So especially with the lighting, which is very dark and very brooding. So as a result, you don't really miss the phenomenal John Napier set. I don't know if you remember David Richards, when he reviewed the show, said the mansion has landed because indeed the original set floated up and down to give other sets gets a chance below it. But wonderful, wonderful, wonderful production, I think, of this show. And Glenn Close, frankly, I think is better than she was originally. And I'm not the only person I've heard say that. Maybe it's because she has the extra years. I don't know if it's supposed to be 50, but, you know, 50 today, after all, we perceive differently than 50 was perceived in 1950. So the fact that Glenn Close is, let's say, in her late 60s, does even better by the property. Now, okay, so how's everybody else? Everybody else is terrific, I think. And frankly, I think that this cast comes close to reaching or surpassing the original one. So I really liked Michael Xavier, I don't know how it's pronounced, who's playing Joe Gillis, who has to start the show narrating. He narrates every now and then, comes and goes as a narrator, but is more a character because what happens is he's a screenwriter who's really having trouble. His car's about to be repossessed. He drives away from the people chasing him and pulls into a garage, and it turns out to be Norma's garage. She was a silent film star, made a lot of money. Don't forget, in those days when the silent film stars, a lot of them made their money before there was such a thing as the income tax. So she still, money is not a problem with her. And she has a very, very, very devoted manservant, wonderfully played by Fred Johansson. And you will see that there's much more to that relationship than you think. And Joe winds up staying around because Norma has a script and she wants it filmed by Cecil B. DeMille, who's still working. She is not, but he is. And Joe has nothing else on his plate and doesn't have any money, and she agrees to pay him money. It is established at one point that she isn't quite paying him, but nevertheless, what else does he have to do? And he's being supported. But of course, Norma wants romance too. And whether or not he provides that is part of the crux of what happens in the first act. Siobhan Dillon is Betty Schaefer. Now, Betty is working at the studio, and she winds up infuriating Joe because she doesn't recommend one of his scripts to the big boss there. But eventually they forge a relationship, a professional relationship, as co-writers of a script that she had read earlier that he wrote that she really believes in, but she has ideas for it, but she needs help. So will they work together? Will they fall in love together? That's another question that comes up at Sunset Boulevard. And what will happen when Norma finds out about them? So many of you know the story anyway. I probably didn't have to go into that much detail, given the fact that so many people know this 1950 movie, although I'm not sure our younger listeners do, because so many of them resent and rebel against black and white movies, which this indeed is. It's true. Believe me, I talk to a lot of young people who say, I wouldn't watch a black and white movie. Well, this is one you should watch, and you should go to the musical as well, because it really is quite, quite good. And I'm very glad that it's back. Now, Sunset was once the biggest money loser in Broadway history. And, of course, no, Spider-Man made its definite seem like chump change. But I think recoupment seems very likely for this one, because even though the production was supposed to close in May, now it's extended to June, and who knows. And this is good for new theater fans who are either unborn or too young to catch it in 1994-95 and will now be able to see what they missed. And that includes Glenn Close-Up, who's ever ready for her. Glenn Close-Up, that's great. That's a mashup, huh? Yeah. But it is. But it's true, because the famous line is, I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille. And I think when the people who hadn't seen it in the past, without the baggage that accompanied it way back when, I think they're going to say, how could she in this show have ever failed? Well, I don't think she failed, because, of course, she did get a Tony Award. And in a way, a lot of people wish she hadn't, because then she could get one now. You can only one to a customer for each role that you play. So it's, in a way, it's too bad. I wouldn't mind giving her a sustained excellence Tony for what she's doing, because I really do believe she's as good as she was then. I think she's better now.
All right. Michael, what did you think?
Well, I think she thinks she's better or as good as she was the first time. And a lot of theater critics seem to as well, as evidenced by her three curtain calls, which I don't know if I've ever seen anything like that in my life on Broadway, three solo curtain calls. I thought it was really excessive. That said, in terms of acting, and according to my memory, I liked her better this time than the first time, because Norma is a very difficult role. She has to be there are moments when she goes to her default silent movie star mode and becomes very, very grand and very broad in her gestures and almost comical. But then she has, of course, her many private moments with when she's alone with Joe or Max in her home, where we have to see her as a real person. And according to my memory, I think she actually negotiated that better this time, Glenn Close did. Singing-wise, I'm sorry, guys. There was a lot of really, really bad singing, including off-pitch singing, which, you know, should not really be acceptable on Broadway. I think it takes... I don't think you can compensate for off-pitch singing. My opinion is that she sounded great in her lower register, in her belt register, and she also sounded lovely in her upper register when she was singing softly. But the middle is kind of a mess, and I think people should be prepared for that, because I don't think this is being communicated to people. As far as the show, I agree that the music at the beginning is some of the best music in the show. I think it so beautifully sets up the mood, and it does sound like it is from a 1950s film noir movie. I think there are several wonderful songs in the show. I particularly like With One Look. I like very much The Perfect Year, which is that duet that Norma and Joe do on New Year's Eve. And I really love with As If We Never Said Goodbye as a song in itself, but I have always questioned, and I would like to ask your guys' opinion on this. Don't you think that it's out of character in the sense that she, that character, would be very unlikely to present herself as that vulnerable and emotionally open in front of these people at the studio?
Oh, I never thought that she was singing it to them.
I always say it was an internal monologue.
Well, you know, I'm glad you said that, because I can't exactly remember how it was done originally, although I think it's on YouTube, so you can look it up. But in this case, yes, when she starts, the lights do go down on everyone else and the spot comes up on her.
But then
she does start interacting with people. At one point, she went over to Nancy Anderson and I think even held her hand. So I think maybe that was not a good directorial choice, because I can very much buy it if it's supposed to be an interior monologue and she's not supposed to be actually singing to those people.
I'm not sure that she's actually communicating what she's singing to these people that she approaches. I think she's just looking at them, touching them. But I don't think that they're supposed to be hearing what she's actually singing. It's all interior as far as I'm concerned. So this is not a problem for me. What I do find interesting, by the way, in comparison, is that, of course, this is a moment we saw in a Jerry Herman musical, Mac and Mabel, when Mabel Norman comes back to the studio after not as long an absence, I'll grant you. But it's funny that Jerry Herman took a different stance by having everybody else react. Isn't it wonderful that Mabel is back here when Mabel comes into the room? While Andrew Lloyd Webber and Amy Powers was a very important component to this song before she gave way to Don Black and Christopher Hampton. But it really is something to hear from the vantage point of the person who's there. And what's also wonderful about that moment is the fact that there are two employees who are still on the scene from when she was there, and they remember her. And I love the fact that this reiterates the fact that you can be a star and fade, but slow and steady wins the race. If you really want to have a job, maybe being behind the scenes is the way to go, because there are these two guys behind the scenes who are still working all these years later. And it's nice that they both have fond memories of her. when she enters the studio, I want to say this too. I know I'm getting off the subject of the song, but I love when she says there would be no Paramount Pictures if it weren't for me. And I believe she's right about that, that these stars did make these studios and then were forgotten while the studios had enough money to go on. And it's a very sad fact of life that the studio system abused these people and then didn't care about them after a while. So there's a lot of texture here in Sunset Boulevard, but I know I got off the subject of the song. So go back, Michael. Continue.
No, that's okay. I think that whole sequence is so beautifully set up, and it's all from the movie, that even the fact that when she arrives in her car, there are the two guys at the gate, security guards, I guess. And one of them is like, you know, who are you? And you don't have a pass and you can't come on. But then the other one has been there longer and he knows who she is. Mm-hmm. And so he's, you know, and he's like very respectful and Miss Desmond, you know, and she says, tell your friend to learn some respect. Mm-hmm. And then when she comes in, you know, into the actual studio, there are, of course, most of the people are younger and they don't know who she is. But mm-hmm. then there's Mr. DeMille there, and he treats her with the utmost love and respect, to the point of not being able to bring himself to tell her that it turns out that the reason that she got a phone call was not because somebody wants to make her movie that she wrote the screenplay for with Joe, but because they want to use her car in a movie. So he can't bring himself to tell her. And then, of course, that wonderful, wonderful moment where the guy on the spotlight, mm-hmm. who I always thought his name was Hawkeye, but apparently it's Hawkeye.
Yeah, that's Hawkeye, what I thought
yeah.
it was.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. Where he spots her and he shines the light on her and the music swells up. And that's a really great moment. But I think that the show has a lot of very nice individual songs in it, but I think its tremendous downfall is that there is far, far too much sung dialogue in it, and the sung dialogue is incredibly badly written. I'm surprised that doesn't bother you more, Peter. There are misaccented lyrics and syllables all over the place. There are probably 100 examples, but the one I wrote down is the word screenplay.
Exactly. Yes, I agree with that. It's a great screenplay. Right. Yeah, that is a problem. I agree with that. However, I don't think there are 100. And you know, while listening to that sung dialogue, I was thinking about it a great deal and saying, would we prefer this to be just book material? And I didn't quite feel that I would have liked it more if it were book material and not sung. I sort of enjoyed, maybe because I enjoyed the jaunty melody that accompanies so much of the dialogue. So that may be my reason, but...
On that point, I really disagree. In fact, I think that it's only... There are probably other examples of Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals that I would have been far better if there had been less or no sung dialogue. That seems to be his default mode. And I don't know if it, you know, I mean.
It is a default mode. Yeah, no question.
But also.
That's been a goal since day one for him.
Right. But also, I mean, you know, and not to psychoanalyze, but I don't know if it's mostly a function of ego that he doesn't want to let that much time over to a book writer that he's not where he's not involved. But also I'm thinking it may partly have been because they felt that since the movie is so famous and since a lot of the dialogue is either taken directly from it or based on it, that they wanted to make it more their own. And maybe they felt that if they had left more spoken dialogue, it would have been too similar to the movie. Do you think maybe that's a possibility?
Well, what I really think more than anything else is that way back when, I remember Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice saying what we wanted to do with our musicals is eliminate as much book as possible because we think it's far more entertaining to have music in a musical. So it seems to be a policy going way back when. So I don't think it's that. It could very well be, but I don't think it's that.
Well, for what it's worth, I think that approach works beautifully for Joseph and Jesus Christ Superstar and Evita. Which happened to be the musicals with Tim Rice. So I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if that's because he I think he's just been by far the most talented collaborator that Lloyd Webber has ever had. And perhaps if he had written this song dialogue for this show, maybe I might feel differently about it. But for whatever it's worth, that's what I feel. I think the show as it is would be vastly improved if a lot of that sung dialogue was taken out and just recast as spoken dialogue. Michael Xavier or Javier, I have no idea.
It's Xavier.
Is it? You know that for a fact?
Yeah.
I tried to look it up. Did you find the pronunciation listed or did you find a YouTube clip or something?
No, he's going to come on and talk with us in the next few weeks.
Okay. And you know what's interesting? In looking up how to pronounce it, I noticed I found his bio on Wikipedia, actually, and it said he went to St. Francis Xavier College in Liverpool. Do you suppose maybe he took his name from there?
You can ask him.
I mean, it's kind of a coincidence, isn't it?
No wonder they didn't turn him down, you know, so they had to accept him. Yeah.
As I may have mentioned, I saw Michael just a few months ago in the Secret Garden in Washington, D.C. at the Shakespeare Theater as Archie, and he was excellent in that. I thought he did a fine job as Joe also. And any negative thing I would have to say about his performance is probably in the material itself. So I thought he did a fine job, and he sang beautifully, and he certainly looks great, which is...
Well, yeah, when he starts the second act by emerging in the skimpiest of skivvies and soaking wet from a dip in that swimming pool, he's not above acknowledging the swoons from the audience. You know, Norma constantly states that through the movies, we taught the world new ways to dream. But when he puts on his bathrobe and then takes off and kicks away his swimsuit, I think he's doing the same for much of the crowd, teaching them new ways to dream. So
anyway, I guess that's pretty much what I have to say about Sunset. I'm generally in the camp of it really being. It's funny. The friend that I went with is a newish friend, and we had we had never really discussed this show, and we certainly never seen it together. And we're sitting there, and I'm reacting to certain moments in the sung dialogue, especially, and in certain other things. And he's like, did you not remember that this is a really bad musical? And I said,
I beg to disagree.
I know you do. I know. Well, I don't know. And there seems to be kind of a, generally speaking, I get the impression that there's a revisionist thing going on now. Now, I don't know if specific people who didn't like it back then are liking it now, but it seems in general that it's being much better received as a show itself. So I completely disagree with that, but I do have that.
No, that is true that there is more appreciation now than there was back then, maybe because so many musicals that have happened since then have not been so hot. And we are looking at it in that light. So that could very well be the case. We have to remember, too, that Sondheim was working on this show once upon a time. And I remember his telling me that he was going full force, and he was at a party, and there was Billy Wilder, and he said, "You know, I'm working on Sunset Boulevard as a musical," and Billy Wilder shook his head sadly from side to side and said, "No, it has to be an opera, because she's a fallen queen," and he said that made perfect sense to me, and I stopped right at that moment. But maybe this is what we have. Maybe that's why we have that sung
dialogue.
It's an opera.
Well, that is interesting, and I have heard that quote. I'm not sure. Do you have any clue, Peter, to how far Sondheim got?
No. No.
And of course, we must mention that at the time, Norma was going to be Angela Lansbury.
Yeah.
Which
was also the first choice for The Visit, too.
Yes.
She was going to be in The Visit as well. Yeah. And there was another Sunset Boulevard musical somewhere along the way that Gloria Swanson was actually doing. There is a recording, like a type of demo or something like that. I don't think it ever got produced. It lives somewhere.
Yeah, I'm sorry. She sang at least one song on television.
That's right. Yeah.
I think that is on YouTube, too. And she had a lovely soprano voice.
Yeah.
Not what you'd expect, really. Yeah, that that's a definite, huge, unbelievable might have been in musical theater history.
Something else has occurred to me in terms of Sunset Boulevard. This is spoiler alert. But anyway, Norma eventually kills Joe because she's jealous that of his relationship with Betty Schaefer. She thinks it's still going on. He's broken with her, and rather cruelly, but he needs to do it to make her hate him. But anyway, she kills him. However, they've been working on the screenplay for this project called Blind Windows. And in real life, I have a feeling that movie would get made with all this controversy surrounding the guy who was shot by Norma Desmond. He wrote the script, and here it is. I bet that movie would get made. So Joe might have had a posthumous hit movie or a posthumous bomb. Who knows? But it was something that did occur to me, and it's fun to speculate. Michael, you can only hope that Andrew Lubrepa writes a sequel to Sunset Boulevard, where it's all about Blind Windows getting made and being a hit or a flop. That's all you can hope for, because maybe he'll get it right the next time in your eyes. We'll see what
happens. I'm a little confused. You're talking about the screenplay about Salome?
Not at all.
No. The when he writes Betty Schaefer. The Betty Schaefer.
When he writes with Betty.
Oh, Betty. I'm sorry. I thought you said Norma. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, but then he also he theoretically collaborates on the Salome screenplay with Norma.
Sure. No, I'm not offering much hope for that. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, one of the sad things is, in a way, it makes us think a little less of Joe as a writer. Now, of course, she is watching him like a hawk. And as she says, I won't have it butchered. We don't quite see scenes where they argue about what that script is or what it should be. But we do see it originally as being a very, very thick set of pages. And we assume he cut it down. But the fact that Cecil B. DeMille refers to it, I think the word he literally uses is dreadful. Who knows how much he could have done with it. But maybe
I'm sorry. I mean, isn't the whole point that he's just placating Norma?
Yeah, that's true. You're right there. And yet I would think he would give it his all and do the best job he possibly could. That may be a very pie in the sky, wishful thinking on my part. But he seems to be sincere as a writer. So I would think he would. And all of us, you know, whenever we look at any property, you know, we think of what we could do with it and improve it. Whether or not we could is another story. But it's impossible for so many of us not to think in those terms. So given the actual assignment, and Salome is a big character. I mean, certainly there have been a number of properties based on her. So, yeah.
The point is that she's not allowing him to do
what
he wants.
Yeah,
and we see that one moment that you cited where he wants to throw it. What does he see? The scene in the marketplace or whatever? This is something like that. And this has to go, no.
Yeah, especially, you know, you can't be in every scene, you know, whatever
right.
She says.
About,
you know, of course, they come only to look at me. Anyway, I'll stand by my opinion, and I am so
stand
used
by mine.
To yes, of course. And I am so used to hearing people argue with me about Sunset Boulevard. I've come to take it as a matter of course. But I don't really believe that there's a better musical to be made of Sunset Boulevard than the one we have on Broadway right now.
So let me jump in a few points before we wrap up with Sunset. I don't think that either one of you talked about the sound and amplification, did you?
No.
And I'm sorry I didn't, because I thought it was excellent.
Really?
You didn't.
Did you have a problem with it?
Yeah, I felt like they had 40 pieces up on that stage. Why are they amplifying it? I would love for them to do, you know, some sort of live orchestra only with no amplification. Mm. I felt that the strings
sound much more Hollywood. That's what I got. That it felt so much Hollywood to me, and so I liked it for that reason.
Well, that's interesting, James, because you know I have mentioned that many times about many.
I really
shows
thought that you were going to lead with that. Yeah,
I guess maybe I'm just talking relatively speaking. I guess it was a little over amplified, but but much less so than so many other things that I've seen. And of course, I mean, they would never, I'm sure you know, nowadays they would never completely unamplify it, even though it is in the Palace Theater. Mm-hmm. And the orchestra is on stage, and it would probably sound great. But the thing is, you know, they would have to obviously amplify the singers. And the thought is that you're not supposed to mix amplified with unamplified sound. So, but that doesn't mean they couldn't have, you know, turned down the volume a little bit.
Can't we get Scott Siegel in there to do a Sunset Unplugged? Sunset Unplugged there. Mm-hmm. I really, really enjoyed this production. I thought it was wonderful. I thought that the audience that I was there, the same that I was this week, they knew every comma and every phrase of the show inside and out, and they were waiting for it. I thought the audience was mostly there for Glenn Close, and that I think that she was amazing. I thought that she was great, and that folks should see this, even if you have seen it before. I was a little freaked out about that mannequin hanging from the ceiling for the whole show. Uh-huh. It was so strange. You know, they spent so much time taking care of other details, and just to leave the mannequin hanging from the ceiling.
I was surprised that it wasn't able to fly completely out.
Yeah.
But that said, you know, I mean, other people had mentioned it, but I really didn't. My eye, you know, it certainly wasn't lit after it rose up.
Sure.
So I wasn't that distracted. I really liked the film clips, old black and white.
Those were great. Yeah.
I couldn't tell if it was all stock footage. I think maybe it was, possibly some of it was, new film made to look like old black and white stock footage, but whatever. I thought it was very effective. And
Sunset Boulevard, that had to have been stock footage because that would have been way too expensive to recreate.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, with all those old cars.
Old cars. Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was wondering if that was from the movie itself. I don't have a copy of Sunset Boulevard, which is appalling that I don't. I'm going to have to really get a copy of that.
I was interested to hear what Peter thought about the car chase.
This has been highly criticized in the reviews, essentially guys are running around holding headlights. And I saw no problem at all with that, especially since the rules of the game here that are established very early is this is much more of a hybrid of a Broadway production and a concert production. So, I thought it was terrifically handled. I saw no problem whatsoever, but I am aware that the reviews have taken him to task for this.
And I had no problem with it, except when the lights were shining directly
at us. Yeah.
And walking out of the theater, there was a couple in back of me, two people I never met in my life. And he's saying to her, I hate it when they do that. It takes me completely out of the show. And I said, sir, I agree with you totally.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I really like the concept of the car chase and the way that they use the entire set and things like that. And I think it's also it gives them a good merchandising availability to sell the Sunset Boulevard car chase set for Christmas, where the car
great
kids
idea.
Can do that.
I'd love to see children running around with those. That
little headlights
wonderful.
Is safe and things like that. And then I felt that the direction by Lonnie Price was very, very good. And I saw new levels to Joe and Betty and Max beyond what I had seen in the previous production directed by Trevor Nunn in 1994. Fred Johnson, Fred Johansson as Max von Meyerling, he gave me a totally new concept of really creepy every time he stepped on the stage. It was creepy to me. Was it creepy to you guys?
Well, and he has that wonderful bass baritone register that George, of course, George Hearn had too. And I think that that's so necessary in that role.
So, I liked him quite
And as Peter mentioned, Glenn Close is not eligible for a Tony Award because she has won it already. But I think that the extension, I think the planned extension that wasn't announced until this week, you know, will put this in the running for a good amount of nominations when Tony Award season rolls around. And
well, you know, since
and I think that they also. And I think since Sunday in the Park kind of pulled the plug on the Tony on the Tony Awards, I think that this is a very good leader in the Best Revival category.
I was just going to say, since neither Glenn Close nor Jake Gyllenhaal are eligible for Tonys, maybe they could co-host the Tonys.
Ah, very good idea.
Yeah,
very good idea. Good for you. Wow. Good for you. What a great idea.
Well, I think actually someone previously had mentioned Jake doing it, but yeah, but why not both of them?
Why not? Why not indeed?
Can't get much more high profile than that.
All right, so that wraps up Sunset Boulevard. We have run very long, so let's throw in a few more reviews and get out of here this morning. Peter, you got down to the Intar Theater to see Fishmen. What did you think about that?
Well, it's a strange title because it has nothing to do with fish. It certainly has to do with men. The cast is composed of five gentlemen. But what it really has to do is the game of chess. And it literally takes place, as the program says, Washington Square Park chess tables. If you've been down there near Waverly Place, Washington Square Park with that wonderful arches, you will see a ton of chess tables there where people play morning, noon, afternoon, and night. And that's what this is about. But what the Fishmen refers to the fact that there are people there who really are trying to fish in, lure in people to play with them and beat them and win a great deal of money from them. And that's what happens here. What really is intoxicatingly interesting is watching these guys play chess. Now, at the end of the show, when I went into the elevator at on 52nd Street, it's a freight elevator. One gentleman out of the blue said to me, you know, I'm one of these guys who plays chess down there at Washington Square Park. And those guys were really playing the game. And to watch them, you know, it's one of those things where they, you know, when they move, they hit the clock, you know, because you only have so much time for the next move, that type of thing. To watch them do this is really amazing. I'm reminded of Chip and Gus, the show we saw earlier in the season where guys actually play ping pong the whole night long. And while that's far more strenuous and exacting than playing chess, the fact remains that this is an amazing thing to watch. Okay, fine. How's the play? Pretty good, because you find it's written by Candido Tirado and directed by Lou Moreno, who does a very good job as well. But it's pretty good because you find yourself switching loyalties. You want somebody to win, and then you don't, and then you do, and then you don't. So they're playing chess with your head, too, here. So I really think this is a worthwhile experience. And one of whom I really enjoyed in the play is somebody who isn't playing chess at all, but is an observer. His character's name is 92. I'm not going to tell you why, but Ed Satrakian plays him, and he plays him wonderfully. I think it's one of the finest performances of the season. And incidentally, and I mean incidentally, this is not important, but if you look at his profile, he reminds me a great deal of Jack Lemmon in his later years. So see if you agree with me. Now, if indeed you go to see it, it's open seating. I urge you to sit near the second of the tables. As you walk in, there's the first table, and then you keep going to the second table because that's where most of the action takes place. So do that if you are going to go. And I do think you would enjoy it. I also want to point out that Max Farah, who is the founder of Intar, who died very recently, is, of course, dedicated, has this production dedicated to him. And I think that he would be very, very proud of it. So I know I certainly was proud of everybody who participated, from writer, director, and all five actors.
All right. Michael, you got down to Joe's Pub where you saw Kyle Ryapko do his show. So why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, this is a one-man version of the show that he did a few years ago at New York Theater Workshop. When it was done there, it was called What's It All About? Baccarat Reimagined, music of Burt Bacharach. This I guess the one man version is called Close to You, Bacharach Reimagined. And that, but maybe the whole thing has been retitled because that is also the title of the new album from Ghostlight Records, which is actually of the London production of the version of the show that we saw at New York Theatre Workshop, which, by the way, that New York Theatre Workshop version, I would say it was is one of the most theatrical of this type of show that I've ever seen. The most in terms of the staging, the wonderful staging, and the way the songs were constructed, were ordered, and the through line that was constructed for the show, which, you know, which was all Kyle Riabko. There were some wonderful, really wonderful staging in that production, including a moment which I will never forget, and I'm happy to say is on the cover. It's the cover image of the out of the CD. It at one point during the show, you know, there are of course lots of love songs in it because Bacharach and Hal David wrote so many wonderful love songs. And at one point in the show, as I'm sure both of you will remember if you saw it, Kyle is singing to a girl and he takes her in his arms, but he also has his guitar in his arms. And so he pulls her close to his body, and then the guitar is against her back. The back of the guitar is against her back, and he played the guitar while she was in his arms. And it was one of the most beautiful romantic moments I've ever seen. And that is, as I say, the image of the album cover. In this Joe's Pub version, as I say, it was only him, so he could not recreate that moment. I guess he could have grabbed a woman out of the audience, and she probably would have been glad to do it. But he did not. He did a wonderful solo, one-man version of the show with a lot of stories of his collaboration with Burt Bacharach. He initially met him when Kyle was hired as a session singer, I guess, especially for a project that Bacharach was working on. And he was, I think, 22 at the time, Kyle was. And then he loved the music so much that he began to explore it and put this show together. And it was a huge hit at New York Theatre Workshop with amazing reviews. And then, as I say, it went to London and they did record it there. I suppose it's still true that it's cheaper to do recordings of that type in London than in the States. So I guess maybe that's why it happened. But anyway, it's a wonderful recording. And I was so glad to see him do it at Joe's Pub, even in a one man version. He's very, very talented as a musician and a singer. The great thing about the show, one of the great things about it, is that how he reimagined all of the songs to an extent and made them his own, but without in any way betraying the original harmonic structure or anything like that. And that's not easy to do. So on every level, I think what he has created is a really great success. And he only did two performances at Joe's Pub recently on February 15th and 18th. And I was very glad to see one of those.
Michael, guessing that you weren't in on the interview that we did with Kyle on Broadway Radio?
No, I actually asked Dan Fortune, who's the press agent for this project, and he said that I think it was – I didn't know if it was one of the daily podcasts or if I just was absent, but no, okay, I was not present for that.
Yeah, I don't recall. It was few months back, 3-4 months back or something like that. But we talked to Kyle, and I'll dig that up and put a link to that in the show notes in case you are interested in listening to Kyle. We talked about the London production and his work down at Joe's Pub and the evolution of from New York Theatre Workshop to London to Joe's Pub and things. It was a really great interview, but I thought that you were in that, but evidently you were not. So
no.
I'll put a link in the show notes to that.
All right. So next up, Peter, you saw Jonah and Otto at the Lion Theater. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I wish I could be more enthusiastic, but this is a play about an older man and a younger man. And at the beginning, we think that the older man is, who's Otto, by the way, is going to be interested in Jonah sexually. That doesn't quite happen. Nothing quite happens. Every time you think you have a handle on what this play is about, it goes into a different direction. You say, oh, so it's not going to be about that. All right. What's it going to be about? Is it about friendship? Is it about the fact that people of different ages can be friends? Wait a minute. Is he exploiting him? One of the most bizarre scenes I have ever seen, and don't forget I'm closing in on 11,000 trips to the theater, occurs when Otto is sleeping on a bench. Maybe he's pretending. Maybe that's the point of it. But anyway, Jonah strips him down to his underwear without Otto waking up at all. Now, don't you really think that if somebody's taking off your jacket, your shirt, your pants, your shoes, that you might at least stir a little? More interestingly to me is that when Otto eventually does wake up, there's a good 10-minute scene in which he doesn't demand his clothes back, which, by the way, Jonah is now wearing. So 90 minutes seemed longer. Credit, though, has to be given to Sean Gormley, who played Otto, a very good actor. We certainly enjoyed him recently in A Day by the Sea at the Mint Theater. The reason I really wanted to see it, though, is I heard wonderful things about Rupert Simonian as Jonah, and he is terrific. So I'm looking forward to seeing him in a much better property as time goes on, because he's an actor to watch. He really was into what he was doing, and the passion was there. I just wish that there were more in Robert Holman's script that I could have tied into, enjoyed. But it was like, you know, when there's a fly in your apartment and you're trying to track it down and it's always escaping you, so did the message, theme, and plot of this play. I have no idea what it's about.
Oh. Mm. All right. So last up this morning, Michael, you got over to see the latest Fathom event, which is the Newsies movie. So tell us what you thought about it.
Well, I won't go into detail about how I feel about the show itself, because we've been running long and I've done that before. Briefly, I think that Harvey Fierstein solved some of the problems of the original movie screenplay, but added some others. The new songs by Alan Menken and Jack Feldman, I like some of them better than others. But I have to say, this is a very, very, very well done, extremely successful video version of the show that was what word do you use? Shot, not filmed, I guess, because I very much doubt that it was on actual film. It looks digital to me, but in the best way. And it was done at the Pantages Theater, I believe, in LA, which with basically the touring cast of Newsies, but with several of the original leads brought back for this occasion, including Jeremy Jordan as Jack Kelly and Carol Lindsay as Catherine. This was a really fun event at Lowe's Lincoln Square at Broadway and 68th on Monday, February 13th. A lot of the cast and creatives were present, including Jeremy Jordan, Carol Lindsay, Ben Fankhauser, who plays Davy, the original Davy, and Andrew Keenan Bolger, the original Crutchy, also in the movie. The creative team, I saw Jack Feldman. I did not see Alan Menken. I think he was announced to be there, but I didn't see him. Maybe I just missed him. Nor did I see Jeff Calhoun, who directed the show. If he wasn't there, I was really, you know, I'm sorry, because it was a great success and the audience loved it. Harvey Fierstein was also present, and so was Christopher Gattelli, the original choreographer. The TV direction was very well done. I thought I didn't think that the cutting was too frenetic at all. Someone else expressed that opinion, but I disagree. I thought it was a really nice balance between full stage shots and close-ups, and I don't think that there was too much cutting. I think it was actually pretty ideal the way it was done. So I think that people will – anyone who loved the show is going to love the video. And if you didn't see it, now obviously it'll be made available to a far, far larger audience. I'm not sure what the long-term plan is for it. It just had, I believe, a couple of dates in theaters. I don't know if they're going to make it I imagine they must. It must be the case that they'll make it available on home video at some point. But we'll see. I hope you get to see it one way or another.
Michael, Crutchy, I'm told, has a song in the second act now.
Yes, which apparently had been at some point and was cut. I don't know if it was cut during previews or before they even started on Broadway. But yes, and it was a very, very nice moment. It's when he's after he's been dragged off to, what is it, a detention home he's put into, some horrible play. And he's all alone, and he's he writes a letter to Jack. And it's very, very, very nice song. One of the best new songs, I would say. So I'm really glad they put it back. And it was nice that Andrew had that moment, because he does a really wonderful job with it. And Jeremy Jordan, you know, I mean, he's a real star. So I'm glad that they brought him back.
All right. Well, hopefully you can get out and see this movie still. I think it's got one more date in a couple of days, the 22nd of February. The Fathom Events is playing it, and then we'll have to see how else it shows up, if it shows up on demand or if it shows up again in the movie theaters or on DVD. But we will let you know as we know more information about that. So before we wrap up and get on to trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. I want to let listeners know that some of the listeners would like to listen to just This Week on Broadway and not all the other shows in the Broadway Radio feed, and there is a way to do that. So please email me if you would like to do that, and I will explain to you how to do that. We are about to relaunch the website for BroadwayRadio.com, and it'll be much easier to subscribe to individual shows rather than all the shows on one feed. It just hasn't launched yet, but there is a way to do that if you want to get ahead of the curve. You can find us on Google Play, on iHeartRadio, on iTunes, and anywhere else that you find finer podcasts, including the Stitcher app. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as the show notes. We'll link to a bunch of things, including the Newsies movie trailer, which is really a lot of fun. So you can check that out, and the interview with Kyle Riabko, and a bunch of other things that we have there. All right, so Peter, why don't you give us the answer to last week's trivia?
I asked, what do these Tony-winning musicals have in common? Applause, Bye Bye Birdie, Damn Yankees, Fiorello, Kismet, The Pajama Game, 1776, The Wiz, and Wonderful Town. Well, they've all been produced by Encores. That was what I was looking for, because it occurred to me while being at Encores the previous week. And Donald Tessioni was the first to get it, followed by Linda McEwen and John Curcio. And I thank them all for participating. And Michael, you have a trivia question this week, I'm told.
Yeah. My question is, what major featured character in a 1960s musical shares a surname with a minor featured character in a 90s musical?
Uh-huh.
And there's a hint, if one is necessary. Both shows have been revived on Broadway within the past 10 years, one much more recently than the other.
All right. So if you know the answer to that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com. We'll let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And could you take me back? Could you take me at my word?
don't know what the hell it's worth, but it's one you haven't heard. And if you let me, you won't regret me being home.
Welcome home.
Staying home.
Welcome home.
Calling home from work each day just to to lay my toothbrush